Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of 4Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics. I'm Andrew, and as per usual, I'm joined by my co-host Rob.
Hello!
And Mick.
Hello!
So, how are we all doing this week?
Good. Good.
Yes, I too am reasonably well.
That's good. That is within the acceptable limits of wellness.
Yes. How are you?
Well, as you might be able to hear, we are playing another fun installment of Is Andrew All Right? He Doesn't Sound All Right.
Oh, that game where we have to take the stick and find out what's inside your nostrils.
Yes, that's right.
The problem is, Rob, I can never tell whether it's one of those weeks where we're not sure whether Andrew's well or not because of how he sounds, or whether it's one of those weeks where the way he sounds is because it's one of his weeks where he spends the week with his head in a sock.
Andrew, have you been robbing banks again?
You can't prove nothing, pig.
So what's today's show about then, Andrew?
Well, today is another one of our semi-regular reviews blowout specials.
Awesome.
By which I mean, we've had too many comics and we need to get through some of them.
Yes.
I like these episodes. I like to think of them as no prep required.
Yes. No prep required episodes.
Mick. Don't give away why we do these.
I'm going to kick things off with a real doozy. This is, it's Halloween month, and this is absolutely perfect for Halloween. If you're not reading it, then just for Halloween, start reading it. Immortal Hulk, Abomination. It's so good.
Ooh, yeah, now you get into the real meat.
Yes, oh, meat is the operative word for this volume.
So much meat.
I mean, this is by Al Ewing with art by Joe Bennett and inks by Rui Jose, Belladino Bravo, Mark Deering. Colours by Paul Mounts and Rachel Rosenberg. And letters by VC's Corey Petty. And this, literally, the first... Oh, what happened there?
Yes, that's a good point you make, Rob.
What? No, I just got a bong from somebody.
Yeah, because Andrew dropped off and rejoined.
Turns out that was the leave call button, not the mute microphone button.
Who knew?
Oh, shall we keep that in? Maybe. We don't know yet.
Probably.
Immortal Hulk. The very first page that you see is this two-page spread of Banner transforming into the Hulk, and it's like, it's absolute body horror. It's glorious in how weird and twisted and disturbing it is. It's so good. And then...
That's one of the ones where it's kind of, it's like the Hulk is sort of twisting out of him.
Yeah. I love that phrase, twisting out of him. Anyway, this starts off with a very kind of, you know, B-movie horror page with somebody frightened and you see a looming shadow and just this distorted, twisted hand that looks like it's about to murder somebody. It's total, you know, those B-movie horrors that you got from the 1950s and 60s where it has someone going, ah, on the poster.
Yeah.
Total B-movie page. And this is a total B-movie comic book, but in the best way possible. So you start off with the scientists at Shadow Base Site B, who are working on a thing. They're doing a thing, and the reporter woman, she's also trying to unsee the things that she saw while she was having her little trip with the Hulk. But now, there seems to have been a problem. The property registered to Elizabeth Ross Banner has a giant hole in the side, so what is going on? She has to go find out. Meanwhile, Doc Samson is with Bruce, and they're trying to figure out what's going on because apparently Rick Jones's body has been stolen. That leads them to a secret base where there are a lot of gamma beasts and a lot of other things. And the guys who are running Black Site, they have a tactic to get Banner into the line of fire instead of Hulk, which is turning on the lights to a daylight setting. But it's not Banner in charge of the body at the moment. No, it's a man with grey eyes who's in charge of the body at the moment. A man who knows how to fight. A man who knows the mean streets of Las Vegas. And he knows how to get things done. Doesn't he, Andrew?
He does indeed. I'll admit that this is basically one of those twists that you kind of need to be aware of 90s comic, 90s Hulk comics to get.
Yeah.
But I love it.
I'm not going to have to read this one, am I?
No, you're not. It's okay, Mick. You just... You can play with your Rubik's Cube or whatever you do.
It's all right, Mick. Don't worry. Anyway, this is glorious in how it takes the character of Banner, the timid Banner, but makes him fight like a proper street fighter at times. It does throw up a little bit the history of Hulk's grey iteration, Joe Fixit.
Yeah, because that's who's in control.
Yeah. And there's a glorious bit, though. The way he turns the tables on the guys running Blacksite, it's amazing in how smart it is. Al Ewing's a genius when it comes to writing this, because I didn't think of doing that. I was thinking, how's he going to get out this? And then there's just this brilliant image of this massive, multi-armed, multi-headed version of the Hulk who's just getting bigger and bigger because of the amount of gamma radiation. And then you get...
The multi-Hulk.
Yeah. Sorry. When I was a kid, there was a multicultural centre here. And for some reason, culture just got replaced with Hulker. Multi-Hulkeral centre for everyone who wants to be Hulk. Anyway, aside from my bad puns, we also find out what's happened to Betty Ross Banner, which is also twisted and distorted and also... It's just... Oh, wow. An abomination, oh my god. Emil Blonsky, but this is more abomination than abomination has ever been, isn't it?
Yeah, I really love the new design, where it's like the old abomination, but instead of a face, it's just like another pair of hands closed around to like make a head.
Yeah.
And then they open up and you see like some rotting corpse head and they just like spew out acid.
Yeah, you can't quite make out what he's saying. It's either help kill me or help kill Hulk, isn't it?
Yeah, which is really neat because it's... Are you going to say the twist with Abomination?
No, I'm not going to say the twist with Abomination. Okay. I'm not going to say anything like that. What I am going to say is it's interesting that even in a monsterized form, Betty Ross Banner still knows what Bruce and Hulk need more than anything else, doesn't she?
She does, in ways that you might not expect at first.
Gruesome and horrible ways that you might not expect at first. I mean, that picture where you just see the shot of Abomination and Betty and Hulk, who's missing like arms and legs and has basically been eviscerated, that to me is just like, wow. And then you find out, because that's the last page of that issue, and then you find out what exactly is kind of going on, what happened at that point. But what got me about this was the very, very end of it, where Bruce is floating in a void, and there's a guy who has a red and blue uniform floating on a little kind of rock in space, and you have a very gaunt, looks like undead version of Bruce Banner.
Oh, yeah, this is the one where it's like a bajillion years in the future, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that red and blue guy, he has a character called Mr. Immortal.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a really fun reference for Al Ewing to throw in.
Yeah, I love the fact that at the end of everything, when all the stars are dying, when entropy's closing in, it ends with just the big words, Metatron. And you've just got Bruce, who is probably the only thing left alive in the universe at that point, and Metatron saying to him, what will you become?
Yeah, which, incidentally, in like a more recent issue, they finally follow up on that bit.
I love Immortal Hulk. I think it's, my God, it's so good. It's literally one of the best comics I've read ever.
It is. Because, I mean, I think we haven't even mentioned just how good the character stuff is as well.
No, the character stuff is amazing.
I think Betty Ross has a great line where, like, someone asks her where she doesn't turn back, and she's just like, because this is where I've always been.
Yeah. And there's a great
like some
bit...
big, horrifying monster woman.
Yeah. There's a great bit with Doc Samson as well. Hulk is killing all these gamma beasts, and Doc Samson is having this monologue. He says, Sometimes it's a great green beast smashing because it's the only way it can let the pain out. Sometimes it looks at you through stone grey eyes that know just how to hurt you. Sometimes it's the devil himself. And sometimes it looks like just a man, like someone you can trust, like a father.
That's kind of the, like, flying elbow drop of psychoanalysis, isn't
it? Yeah, I know, it's ridiculous. And I love the fact that Hulk is also starting to acknowledge Doc Samson and his psychoanalysis of him as well, which is a really interesting angle, because Hulk's going, that's bad, isn't it? And Doc Samson's going, yes, it's bad. He's like, okay, right, noted.
So, see, progress.
Yes, I know. It's so good. Oh. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about the next volume. Anyway, who's next?
See, the one problem with you reviewing these Immortal Hulk volumes is it makes me want to go back and just reread all of them.
Just do it. Do it, man. Do it. You know you want to.
I'm like Shia LaBeouf.
Do it!
Oh, actually, that reminds me, I do have an important point to make on the show.
Oh, no. No, I'm important. Issue
an official four-panel apology.
Oh?
Because I made a terrible, horrible mistake. I said that Shia LaBeouf gets eaten by bugs in Constantine. When he doesn't, he gets smushed into a ceiling.
It's still a happy ending for the viewer.
Exactly.
Whichever way you slice it, it's a happy ending for the viewer.
Anyway, who's next?
I actually like that film quite a bit.
It's better than people think.
It's just a fun, silly action movie, and Tilda Swinton's really good in it.
Yep, like I said.
Anyway, yeah, Mick, comics, you've got them.
That's right. I have got Straight Out of Brooklyn, which, for all you fact fans out there, is a collection of stories about the only craft beer collecting superhero in the Marvel Universe. That's right. It's camera card carrying Miles Morales.
That's just as funny as the first time we made that joke.
I wasn't here then, though.
I thought, anyway, was it not you who made it the first time?
It was him who made it the first time.
But not on air.
That's right. It was off. You know, I'll give you that then.
Thank you.
It's only in the world outside the podcast that joke's been comprehensively run into the ground.
I know. Anyway. Miles Morales, Straight Out of Brooklyn, is an interesting tome.
Is it because there's not a colon where there should be?
There is no colon where there should be one. It's like he's had some kind of gastric bypass operation. But basically, this is the story of Miles Morales teaming up with that well-known superhero sidekick, the Rhino. That's right.
Wait a minute.
What?
Say what? I know.
Hold on a second while I consult my official handbook of the Marvel Universe. But I'm not 100% on that one.
When you say superhero sidekick, is Rhino...
I guess...
I mean, I guess that there have been times when Spider-Man has defeated him with a sidekick.
Yeah, no. What it is, some kids are going missing. And one of them is the cousin of Miles's kind of girlfriend, which is how they refer to each other. And the other one is the niece of the Rhino's girlfriend. And they run into each other and get into a bit of a scrap whilst on the trail of these missing kids. And after realizing that they're both on the trail of the same thing, they reluctantly decide to team up. And they make quite an effective team of brain and brawn and agility and brawn and spider sense and brawn. They eventually track down the kids, find out what's going on. It's all part of a master plan by Tombstone, who seems to be a fairly, fairly two-dimensional villain. I mean, it's a comic book, so of course he's two-dimensional. But even within the realms of comic bookdom, he seems to be fairly bland as a villain.
Yeah, I think it's just he is the villain here because we need someone who is a bad guy.
Yeah, it's almost like insert a villain here because it needs one. There's also someone called the Snatcher. Guess what he does?
Oh no. No, I don't want to.
He already guessed. You might as well tell him.
No, thank you.
In the meanwhile, Miles is dealing with those everyday issues that every web-slinger has to deal with of, you know, school, relationships, that kind of thing. And his actual nemesis, far more so than Rhino or Tombstone or the Snatcher, is the vice principal of the school, who's determined to prove that Miles Morales may not always be in school when he says he is. So that's running parallel.
So did he finally give up on Ferris Bueller then?
Apparently so, yeah. And this is where it sort of pans out as there's lots of shenanigans around doing the Spider-Man-y things, fighting off the Frost Pharaoh as he does something at the local museum, the Frost Pharaoh.
I actually do quite like that name.
I mean, it's like someone saw King Tut from the 1966 Batman series and went, we need that in the Marvel Universe, but with ice power.
Yeah. I loved them, but we need some kind of Egyptian-themed villain.
Yeah.
What was ancient Egypt incredibly well known for? Oh, yes, it's heavy snowfall.
So there's a sort of crazy chase to try and get back to school in time to not be discovered for having snuck out to prevent a disaster at the museum. And it involves, there's a sort of Scotty Young type, almost like a combination between a two-page spread of a comic book panel and a sort of one of those games you get where you've got to get from one end of the page to the other end of the page in a Christmas annual, which is quite a nice little touch. And then it all rounds off with a showdown with Tombstone, who's trying to run guns throughout Brooklyn. And again, there's a kind of villainous team up, but it's not with a villain. It's with a villain's daughter. It's a flyy villain. It's a flyy villain that was played by Michael Keaton that one time.
Evil Batman.
Yes, it's a Marvel DC crossover. Of course it's not Batman, you fool.
And is it Evil Birdman?
Wait. Yep, it's that actor guy who went a bit mad at the end of Birdman.
Oh, so
close. Is it Evil Beetlejuice?
You're getting cold.
I think you just mean Beetlejuice, Rob.
Beetlejuice isn't evil.
No, Rob, what have you done?
Oh, he said it twice now.
Three times.
No, you said it once.
Does it have to be the same person who says it three times?
Yes. I think so. God, I hope so.
We're safe.
I'm not sitting through that movie again. It's been too long.
What's wrong with Beetlejuice?
Oh, you see, you're on two now.
I think...
Nothing's wrong with the movie. I just don't want to live in it.
I think Betelgeuse...
This is why
is
I haven't said it.
...a perfectly good moon of Jupiter.
Anyway, there's a showdown with Tombstone and the Vulture's daughter to get off that riff. And there's also some interaction with Uncle Aaron, who, it turns out, is not a good man. So...
Gasp! Who would have thunk that, except for everyone who's read a Spider-Man comic or seen Into the Spider-Verse, or is just generally aware of the tropes of storytelling?
And this is the thing. This is my first sort of comic book introduction to Miles Morales. I have watched Into the Spider-Verse. It was a bit too spidery for my liking, as was Into the Spider-Verse in comic book form, or Edge of Spider-Verse, I think I did, because I wasn't brave enough to dip my toes into the full Spider-Verse. And my only complaint about it is that the Frost Pharaoh storyline feels like filler, and because it starts off with Tombstone involved in a caper, and it finishes with Tombstone involved in a caper, you kind of want there to be a Tombstone theme, or at least some kind of link to Tombstone in the intervening pages. But it just feels like that middle section is disconnected in that way that you sometimes get these collections that they don't feel like they've written for the trade. They feel like they've written some individual issues and realize that, oh, actually, five of them work quite well together. Let's put in a sixth issue just in the middle of the run, just for completeness. There's guest appearances by Captain America, just to sort of weigh in. I think Iron Man turns up at one point. And yeah, it's an enjoyable set of stories. It would just be nicer with that more strong linking material. It's written by Saladin Ahmed. Art is by Javier Garon. And letters by VC's Cory Petit. And, yeah, enjoyable introduction to the world of Miles Morales.
Now, VC Cory Petit has been in the first two. Let's see if he's in any more.
Well, he is probably not going to be in this first one because I've gone over to Dark Horse and I have been reading The Mask Omnibus, which is written by John Arcudi with art by Doug Mank and other things by Matt Webb, Keith Williams, Rich Perotta, Chris Chelnor, Gregory Wright, Pat Brosso, David Jackson, and Lewis Buhalis. And, you know, before I start, I should probably full disclosure, this omnibus consists of the original three masked graphic novels, The Mask, The Mask Returns, and The Mask Strikes Back, but I only read The Mask. Because that in and of itself is 150 pages long. Not to spoil too much, but boy, howdy was I aware that that story was 150 pages long. So this book actually ties into last week's theme of, you know, comics that are very different from their eventual movie adaptations.
Yeah, I've read some of The Mask before, and it's nothing like the films.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the films in that it's about a man called Stanley Ipkiss, who finds, like, an ancient mask and puts it on and becomes, like, a living cartoon character.
Yeah.
But then kind of takes a hard turn away from the movies when he immediately goes on like a violent rampage, killing everyone who he feels like has ever wronged him.
Yep.
I think the idea is it's this kind of very post-Watchmen idea of deconstruction where it's like, hey, what if a character was like a Looney Tunes character, but in the gritty real world, and they'd just be a violent, bad person, and it would be like kind of scary, but also, I guess, kind of black comedy, except the kind of black comedy where it's not really that funny.
Yeah, I mean, when you say it like that, it does explain a certain amount of the humor in The Mask, you know? The stuff that just kind of fell flat. I'm talking about the film, especially in the more violent scenes when you saw the mask trying to be funny and it just didn't work.
Yeah, I feel like that's probably maybe, I guess, things that might have been left over from like an earlier draft where it maybe was a bit closer to the comics.
Yeah.
I think. Because I remember when I was doing a bit of research for last week, I think it's only a common misconception that it's like, that they changed it when Jim Carrey was brought on. I think, like, they decided they wanted to go in a more family-friendly direction, probably because, you know, that's more marketable.
Yeah.
And then, like, then they got Jim Carrey involved. So, yeah, that's The Mask movie. Completely insufferable for different reasons than The Mask comic book.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. That's my bold stance here in the year 2019. I don't like Jim Carrey. But yeah,
I'm going to concur with that.
Not even in a series of unfortunate events?
Never seen it, because it's got Jim Carrey in it.
I feel like maybe that one, from what I've seen, is more okay. It's like, it's heyday Jim Carrey, where it's just, here's like a solid 10 minutes of me just talking and talking, and look, I'm doing a funny voice, and now it's another funny voice, and now it's another funny voice,
yeah.
And now I'm going to gurn my face.
Yeah, I prefer him in sort of more straight roles.
Yeah.
Like hit film The Number 23.
That's right, yes.
The Bus We Get to Work.
No, that was the sequel. The Number 23A.
See, I do think that Number 23 would have been better if it was just about his morning commute. Anyway, you were telling us all about The Mask.
Yeah, The Mask, I think. So I think comedy-wise, it's a mixture of, as much as I say it's different from The Mask, the film, I think it does have a similar way of being just like, it's very loud and very in-your-face stuff. Like it's, oh, look, he hit himself with it in the head with a hammer, but he didn't feel a thing, so now he's going to hit himself in the head with a hammer a load more times. And then he's going to, like, you know, shoot himself, and it's just this non-stop parade of sort of tepidly funny gags. And a lot of them just, they're not very good at like setting up and paying things off. Like in the way that like something like Deadpool now would be kind of good at like Deadpool does something and then there's like a beat where maybe there's like a panel with no one talking and then it's like the punchline or whatever. This is just everything, every page is like crammed full of dialogue, like just with no one reacting to anything. It's just, you know, a thing happens and it's on to the next thing.
Yeah, I get what you mean. It's just kind of like machine gun type action comedy, action comedy, action comedy.
Yeah, I think, to be fair, I think there's one gag that I think works, and that's a good example of like how it should have been played, is that like the mask is facing off with some police officers and he like reaches into his jacket pocket and pulls out like what looks like just a stick or something, but then he keeps like pulling and it cuts to like the police people's faces and he keeps pulling, like, you know, it's the whole "that's an impossibly long stick," and then he pulls it out and it's actually a massive battle axe. I'm like, that's fun.
Yeah, that would make me chuckle.
Except for the bit when he then yells, like, I asked you little wussies, is that a bleeping question?
Yeah.
He's also a macho manly man, Rob.
Except when he's not.
Yeah. Oh, also unsurprisingly, in the bits when he's not, from a comic written in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Little bit homophobic.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I think apart from that, it's just, it's not a particularly compelling story.
I think that was the main thing with the mask. It wasn't meant to be a compelling story. It was just meant to be, oh, look, this is fun.
Yeah. Because also to explain one of like the big deviations from the movies, Stanley Ipkiss is only in like half of the first book before he dies. And then like the mask goes to like some random police officer guy. And the idea of the series is like the mask keeps getting picked up by different people. But none of them are particularly nice, to be honest.
No.
Like, I don't know who I'm rooting for in this book, because everyone seems kind of horrible.
Yep.
And it's also, I feel like also that initial twist with Stanley getting killed off and the mask going to someone else, I think that probably works fairly well if, like, I assume this was probably initially like a mini series or something. So that maybe makes sense, like the end of one issue and the start of the next one. But here it just, it feels like a weird jump. Like it's just two separate stories crammed into one book for some reason.
Awesome. So do you recommend it?
I do not know. It's probably, if you are like 12-year-old me back in the sort of early 2000s, yeah, this is probably your jam. But then you're going to grow up and realise that, nah, mate, you're all right.
The jam stayed in the cupboard far too long, now it's gone off.
Yeah, that's the moral of the story. Don't eat green jam.
Oh,
also, the mask is called Big Head, not the mask.
Yes.
So there you go.
Which, ironically, the term Big Head does fit the character that the mask becomes when someone puts it on.
Because he has a big head and also his ego increases.
Yep.
That is called metaphor.
Yes. On to me then.
But what's it metaphor?
Oh, please, Rob, take over quickly.
Look, I refrained on the Snatcher. I'm a loud one.
You are a loud one. You're right.
Oh, God. Right, I'm taking over because you're both becoming like each other now. Right. You're taking my jobs, I don't know, coming over here.
That would have worked so much better on the live video cast.
I know. Right, okay. I have something, and I have to say, one of the people who is involved in the making of this has the most amazing name I've seen in comic books for a while. This is The Superior Spider-Man. And it's volume
that is
one.
That is quite an awesome name for a comic book artist.
This is the Superior Spider-Man Full Otto, which I think is a really fun little pun.
Oh, they get me. They know what I want in comics.
Exactly. But this is by Christos Gage, and it's got art by Mike Hawthorne, and inks by possibly one of the best names in... We should make a list of the best names involved in comic book creation, right? Wade Von Graubadger.
Wow.
With I mean, that actually sounds like the name they'd give to the latest in the X-23 series of mutants.
Exactly. With Victor Olazaba and Andy Owens. Jordi Belair as colours, and VC's Clayton Cowles for letters. But Wade Von Graubadger is just... It's an amazing name.
Wade Von Graubadger.
It is, isn't it?
I guess there's like comic bits.
Yes, there's comic bits. Well. So we're going to leave Mr. Graubadger's name to one side, or Mr. Von Graubadger, to give him his full surname. This starts off with Otto fighting the most heinous of Spider-Man's supervillain foes, who knows that this isn't the real Spider-Man, it's somebody else who's playing the role of Spider-Man, the Stilt Man. And
he has the power of being very tall and incredibly unstable.
Yeah. And you've got some witty repartee between the two of them as they're fighting, with Otto calling... sorry, his name's not Otto in this. We'll get to that in a bit, though. But Otto's calling Stiltman a buffoon and everything like that in the way that Otto Octavius would. But what Otto's really thinking is, should I continue this fight with Stiltman? Because I have an important lecture at Horizon University. It's for the end of term. I have to make it to that as well. I need to sort this out quickly so I can make it to my lecture. Because he is playing the role of Professor Elliot Tolliver. That is his current secret identity. The only problem is that also at Horizon University, because he kind of slips up when he's given the lecture by ending it with to transcend the limits of the universe, first transcend the limits in yourself. So go forth and remake the world. The die is cast.
I mean, to be fair, I've been to university. I wouldn't think that much of my lecture is just doing supervillain monologues and then saying, like, iconic supervillain catchphrases.
I'd think more of my lectures at university if they were doing supervillain monologues. I would actually attend lectures at university. The problem is that Otto Octavius has had two women that he loved in his life. The first one was Mary Alice, and the second one was Anna Maria. The problem is...
I think you mean three, Rob.
Three?
I think you're forgetting the hot, steamy love affair between Otto Octavius and one May Parker.
No, I'm not forgetting that. I'm choosing to ignore it completely, because that just leads to when he took over Peter Parker's body. So anyway, Otto has run into a problem, because when he said the die is cast, it made a certain person very suspicious, because she's heard that phrase before. She heard it from her ex-boyfriend, Otto Octavius, because Anna Maria also works at Horizon University. Anyway, moving on to Superior Spider-Man, who is with his Gravedigger crew, or whoever it is, the bunch of mercenaries who are basically fighting off evil cults. Evil cults.
Nope. Nope.
I literally had to catch myself there.
Just gonna move on.
Do you mean literally or do you mean figuratively, Rob?
Moving on swiftly, Anna Maria's figured out who Elliot Tolliver is, but just in time for him to go and face Terax the Tamer, who has arrived on Earth because Earth is now tamed, apparently, allegedly. So Otto's fighting Terax and things are going well, because Otto is Otto and Terax has the power cosmic, which, you know, things happen. Which means that Elliot Tolliver, I can't call him Elliot, it just doesn't sound natural. I'm going to keep calling him Otto. But Otto ends up in hospital and then he's saving people. And he's slowly realizing that normal everyday people are worthy as well. And there are things that they have to offer that are good and wholesome and stuff like that. And then the demons invade, which leads to him having to team up with Dr. Stephen Strange. And so that's an interesting team up. Dr. Stephen Strange and Dr. Otto Octavius. Steve knows that it's Otto, by the way, which is, yeah, that's a lot of fun. Because it happens while Otto is having a first date, and his date gets infected with a demon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doesn't have a lot of luck, does he, does old
no.
Otto Octavius?
It's a, there's a great close to this, though, which has Anna Maria and Otto talking, and Anna Maria says to him, okay, let's talk first date etiquette. No talking about exes, especially me. Do not say the die is cast. It's played. And for love of God, no supervillain stuff. And Otto's going, perhaps I should try an app. I understand it's all online now. So that's all we need is Otto on Tinder.
Speaking of things, we should move away from very swiftly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, in his old form, he'd have been able to like narrow the field down quite rapidly, wouldn't he? Because he'd be able to swipe three or four at a time.
Anyway, Mick.
Yes. I've got Domino Hot Shots. By which I don't mean my pizza's just arrived.
you've been holding on to that one, haven't you?
Yeah. Actually, that just came to me, literally as I said it.
There was a knock at the door, and a magic circle appeared.
So, this is the latest collection in the run of Domino by Gail Simone. You've got art by David Baldion and Michael Shelfer, and letters by VC's Clayton Cowles.
There he is again.
Hey.
He's been a busy boy.
He has. Well, he's obviously sharing lettering duties with VC's Corey Petit.
Yeah.
So, the tagline for the Hot Shots, which is this nice new group that Domino have got, which has a tagline of always outmanned, but never outgunned. So in this, which has got a nice little cover that's kind of a homage to the Charlie's Angels silhouette that you used to get, but it features Domino front and centre, but actually the other characters that form the foreground come from elsewhere within the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You've still got Outlaw and Diamondback featured, but there are some guest female Marvel characters. So the story is that a meteor falls to Earth, and contained within it is some ancient cosmic power from the time of the Eternals. And what it is very dangerous, and it shouldn't fall into the hands of the wrong people. Unfortunately, that's unknown to the hapless French scientists who go to investigate the crash site and get consumed by the cosmic power. Meanwhile, Domino and her hotshots are recruited by a redhead in a beret in a cafe in Paris. They have a chat, and Domino is convinced she knows this person from somewhere. And eventually it clicks, and she realizes where she recognizes this person from. It's only Natasha. From the Avengers, it's only the Black Widow.
She's that one in them movies.
That's right. The one that looks a bit like the Major in Ghost in the Shell movie.
But, Mick, what are you talking about? Natasha Romanoff isn't Japanese.
I only said a bit like.
Really?
In my defense.
Like they could have some kind of common ancestor.
Yeah. Just so.
A common ancestor who could play any role on the planet. Whether that be man, woman, or tree.
So, it turns out that this meeting isn't as secret as Natasha had expected, because at a nearby table, we meet White Fox, a South Korean intelligence agent. It's all right, because Domino got a lift in a Wakandan craft from Atlas Bear, which is where Atlas and Diamondback are waiting for everybody. So this unlikely and odd team-up start tracking down. And basically, it's kind of an audition piece for the Hotshots. They go to track down this power. There's a lot of infighting. Deadpool turns up because he's been contracted to kill whoever's got the power or is trying to take the power.
Does Deadpool want the power?
No.
Is he going to be...
what Deadpool wants is to fulfill his contract. Either that or get laid. Because this is Deadpool. One of these things happens.
And maybe not the one you think.
Maybe not. Obviously, it's clear that whoever gets his power is going to be dangerous. So, of course, Stark Industries are aware. Along come some remote Iron Man suits called the Falsies to intervene. They get their asses whooped. And reluctantly, Tony Stark agrees to help track down the scientist that's being consumed by this galactic power. Over the course of the adventure, all the girls get touched by the cosmic power of the Eternals, and there is just this massive smackdown. There's a lot of commentary about loyalty to nation, about, you know, whether it's important to prevent one single nation having control of it. Obviously, Atlas Bear wants to take it back for Wakanda. White Fox wants to take it back to Korea. There's some doubt even whether, you know, actually Natasha's going to try and wrest the power and take it back to Russia. The only person who definitely doesn't want the power is Deadpool. But it's it's another solid adventure for Domino, Outlaw and Diamondback, with the added bonus that you get these other characters with different motivations, different approaches. You get the guest appearances from Deadpool and Iron Man, but actually, it would have stood up without them.
Yeah. And it, although, you know, that being said, I'm not going to turn down an opportunity for Gail Simone to write Deadpool again.
Well, no. I'm really enjoying it. It continues to be a solid run, this Gail Simone run of Domino. And it maintains a level. I'd like to say it gets better and better, but it started off strong and just stayed there. It's a good solid run. So I look forward to more of it.
Cool. Well, fingers crossed that there is more of it.
Yes.
Andrew?
Yep, so I have been reading Star Wars Vader Dark Visions, which is written by Dennis Hallam, with art. It's a different artist each issue. So we've got Paolo Villanelli, Brian Level, David Lopez and Javier Pina, Stephen Mooney, and Geraldo Borges, with colours by Arif Prianto, Jordan Boyd, Munsa Vicente, Lee Laffridge, and Marcio Menez, and letters by one of the other ones. It's VC's Joe Caramagna this time.
Wow. Hold on. How many letters do VC need?
Two.
Three?
I think they're four letters. Because off the top of my head, there's like Joe Caramagna, Corey Petit, the other one who we just mentioned, Matt whatever's, Travis Lanham.
But why do they need so many letterers? Because they don't have the same level of output as other comics. Clearly, because they're lending their letterers to everybody else.
Well, I don't think VC is like a comics company. I think they're like maybe specifically a lettering company.
How do you get to be a lettering company?
Yeah. I mean, how does a lettering company come to exist?
And is it like sign writers who write signs?
I don't know, mate. Look, I know it's a fun bit on the show that I am positioned as the comic sage.
Right. Your mission...
But the intricacies and economics of the lettering industry...
Is your homework for next week's show.
Oh, boy. Well, next week was going to be a fun show about horror comics. But no, look forward to our special hour and a half long discussion on how lettering works. Kind of curious now. Oh, no. No, stop it, Brain. Stop it down.
Okay. Before we get on to that, though, how does Darth Vader work?
Yeah. So this is an anthology series, with the idea being that each issue is from the perspective of a different person, and it's kind of how they view Darth Vader and how, you know, kind of people's opinions can change depending on their circumstances.
That sounds pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, it does sound pretty cool. And it is for some of the issues, because the first one, it's really neat. It's a story called Savior. It's about this little alien kid who kind of lives on this sort of post-apocalyptic world where an entire civilization got wiped out by something. And now, like, him and his civilization, they live underground, occasionally, like, come to the surface to forage. And from their perspective, like, the whole war between the Rebel and Empire, that's, like, just gods, like, battling it out in the heavens. When one day, one of those gods kind of comes crashing down on his planet in his mighty fireball and outstrides the Dark Knight with it. No, not Batman, the other one. With his sword of fire.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
It's Darth Vader. And what happens is kind of, so Darth Vader, he's crashed on this planet, he needs to repair his ship. But it turns out he's landed in what they describe as the Ender, which firstly turns out to be the thing that wiped out their civilization. Secondly, turns out to be a big old kaiju. So it's Darth Vader versus a building-sized shark monster.
Does it have lasers?
I mean, he has lasers.
But does the building-sized shark monster have lasers?
No, it just has big old chompers. Yeah. So that one's fun. Because that's like the idea that from, you know, his perspective, Darth Vader's like this great god that's come down to the planet to liberate them from like the monster that's cursed them. Then the second one, Unacceptable, that's really fun too. It's about this Imperial officer who it starts with him kind of, basically they're chasing down a rebel spy. And he escapes, and you see him yelling, "Failure is unacceptable." Then you know his second commander says, "Well, you know, I wouldn't call it a failure. We've still wiped out all the rebels in this area and taken back the system." And so the commander, you know, he kind of has this, "Well, okay, we'll send in a report for now, saying, you know, the mission was a success, and we'll massage in the actual truth a little bit later." Only then he finds out that rebel spy, you know, the one they definitely captured and is in the holding cell right now. Yeah, Darth Vader's coming to pick him up. And we get a flashback to, like, him as a lieutenant watching Darth Vader, like, kill a bunch of officers who failed him while saying failure is unacceptable. And it kicks off basically this whole crazy mission where the commander decides, right, no, we're going after that rebel spy right now. What's that? He escapes into an asteroid field. Don't care. Drive the Star Destroyer in there. We'll take it all on the shields. He's down on a desert planet now. Fine. Send TIE fighters. What's that? Some of them might get lost in like the terrible conditions. Fine. Send all of them. What's that? All our TIE fighters are destroyed now. And the rebel spy is flown into a gigantic space slug to escape. Guess we're ramming the space slug.
Wow.
And it's this great bit of, you know that bit in Empire Strikes Back where the Millennium Falcon kind of goes into the space slug?
Yeah.
Imagine that. Only it's a whole Star Destroyer just like cramming itself down the throat. Guess what? It doesn't go well.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
And it ends with the commander kind of hiding on the burning wreckage of his Star Destroyer when just Darth Vader walks up and says, "Failure is unacceptable." Then it gets bad.
Oh.
Because the third issue is called Tall, Dark, and Handsome. And the idea is, it's like, it's a nurse who works on the Death Star. And she develops, like, a bit of a crush on Darth Vader. And it is what the kids today like to call problematic. Because it falls into this very, like, especially compared to the first story, where it's like, oh, this kid, he thinks Darth Vader is this big hero. Isn't that sweet? This one is like, what's that woman having a crush on Darth Vader? Dames be crazy, don't they?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
And especially because, like, it ends with her sort of sneaking into Darth Vader's quarters. And he immediately just, like, stabs her with his lightsaber. And there's this very kind of...
Was that a euphemism?
Oh, I wish. No, he, like, he just murders her. And it's this kind of very, well, I guess what she got what she deserved for being a crazy broad.
Oh, I just, oh no, no, Star Wars, why?
Well, I mean, I've been asking that since 1977, but.
Yeah, that's just a really uncomfortable story. Which is nice, because that's also the one with the art by David Lopez and Javier Pina, who do a really fantastic job. Just a fantastic job drawing a thing that should not exist. And then we've got two more issues where it kind of just feels like they ran out of ideas. Like, four is about this hotshot rebel pilot who kind of, you know, gets into a dogfight with Darth Vader and loses his bottle. And then, like, the last one's about some guy who runs a bar, but then Darth Vader comes in wanting a thing that he's got hidden, so he goes on the run and Vader hunts him down. And they just seem like very generically Darth Vader-y stories. Like, it feels like they only really had, like, in the original pitch meeting, they thought of three ideas for, like, alternate takes on Darth Vader, and then just ran out. And so just had to, like, shove two more in. So yeah, that's Vader Dark Visions. It's pretty darn disappointing.
Yeah, it doesn't sound up to the standard of the other Vader stuff that you've read. And you've read a fair bit of the Vader stuff as well.
Yeah, I certainly have. And like, this is definitely a come down. But yeah, that's all I have to say about that one. Mick, do you want to do another one?
Yes, I do. And I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, buy this one. And that's before I told you anything about it.
Oh, well, that was easy enough, right? Moving on.
I suppose I better go through the title, really. Otherwise, it'd be really difficult to buy it.
I mean, I don't know. It is spoiling some of the mystique, I feel.
Funny you should use the word mystique. Because it's not about mystique. But it is about mystery. Mystery Science Theatre 3000. Or, as those of us who are familiar with the series will call it, MST3K. So for those of you who've been living under a rock for about the last 20, 25 years, MST3K is a TV show where the crew of a space freighter spend their downtime watching public domain sci-fi movies and riffing on them and basically just narrating their own storyline to make it better than the one that's on screen, often with hilarious results.
Yeah,
I know. I've seen a couple of them, and the one I remember, I actually don't remember the name of the film. But it's like, it's some old sci-fi film where they just keep like coming up with new names for the protagonist.
Yeah.
So it's like Beef Hard Chunk.
Yes.
Slab Man Castle.
So what they've decided to do now is they've started to riff on public domain comics.
So it is actually like Mystery Science Theater, but with comics.
Yeah. So the framing mechanism is that Kinga Forrester, who controls the media empire that their ship is part of, has got a new device called the Bubbleator. And when you're surrounded by the bubbles, it allows you to live in the world of comics. They use a sample from a funny animal comic, and then they plunge the crew of the ship into some pulp 19 sort of 30s, 40s, 50s feeling comics, and they spread them throughout the comics. So some of them appear in multiple issues and multiple stories. One gets thrown into Johnny Jason, Teen Reporter, and the comic becomes known as Tom Servo, Teen Reporter. There's a sort of 30s superhero comic called The Black Cat. She's Hollywood's most beautiful leading lady, but she's bored with her ultra-sophisticated life and takes to crime fighting with an unlikely partner, who is Jonah from the MST3K crew. And then the Crow robot becomes a sort of crypt keeper and appears in an anthology series along the lines of a sort of Creepshow-type, Tales from the Crypt-type comic. And what they've done is they've used a team of artists to match the art styles of the comics that they're riffing on. And to denote where they're riffing, they've marked the speech bubbles that are riffs with a tiny circle. And one of my favourite panels is that one of the Creepshow, it's got sort of Tales from the Crypt type stories, is called The Clay Coffin. And it starts off telling you about Hortense had wealth, talent, and her husband. but she didn't have beauty or love, and even at the cost of death, that was what she was going after. So it tells the story of her loveless marriage to Grover. He's having it away with the maid.
God, he really went downhill once he left Sesame Street.
He did, yeah. And the riff goes, he sets off for work, and it's the normal comic in this panel goes, as he's leaving this beautiful house, which has been paid for by her art. Goodbye, my love. I shall see you at dinner. Don't work too hard at your sculpturing. I won't, dear. Goodbye. And the chauffeur says, and you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. And you may say to yourself, to which Grover replies, well, how did I get here? And then going past is one of the robots on a little sort of scooter going, letting the days go by, I see.
Oh, that's cool. I like it.
And it is. I haven't actually finished it yet, but on occasion it has had me weeping. You know, little things like someone who suddenly gets cast into shadow. What is that stuff on your forehead?
I assumed it was like just a comic set in the world of Mystery Science. That's very good.
Yeah,
we're gonna have to read this, Andrew.
When Jonah turns up at Tom Servo turns up at the house of this Hollywood starlet, her father meets him at the door and says, "Hello, I'm Shelley's father. But for some reason, the artist has painted me as a Lutheran minister." It's so much fun. I can't remember having had this much fun reading a comic in a long, long time. It riffs on all, just like the TV show riffs on all the tropes of 50s B movies and stuff like that. This does the same with comics. Like, you know, sometimes in those old four-colour comics, you'll get a whole panel where the entire kitchen is the same colour. Yeah. Yes, one of the first things Shelley did when she bought the house was turn the entire kitchen pink. it's difficult. There's a guy here who's obviously in a dark room. So they've shaded his face. "You know, Ralph, I suddenly feel uneasy, as if there was something watching us, and that something is really into shading."
Just stop there. I don't want to hear anymore. I want to read this myself.
And another beauty is a guy who's plotting to sabotage something went, "Oh no, my evil hands are glowing."
Stop there, Mick. I don't want to hear anymore.
It's a lot of fun. It ran for 6 issues. It cuts to that there is a comic book element telling you the story of what's happening on the ship, but that's like a couple of pages here and there. They're the glossy pages, and then it emulates the old sort of 40s and 50s comics by having that newsprint feel to some of the pages, and then you go back to the glossy for the story that's unfolding on the ship itself. And it even ends, I've just flipped towards the back of the book, it even ends with them in the comic reading their own comic, which, as you know, kudos for the meta there. It's immense fun. It's written by developed by Joel Hodgson and Harold Buchholz, who were involved in the original MST3K series. It's written by them, Matt McGuinness, Seth Robinson, Cheryl Volpe, Mary Robinson, with the host segments drawn by Mike Manley, Jack Pollock, and Mimi Simon. Letters are by Michael Heisler. And it's just so much fun. It's from Dark Horse Comics in association with Netflix.
Awesome.
Nice.
Oh, Andrew, take us home.
Yeah, that's a thing I can do. So I have been reading Vivisectionary, A Convocation of Biological Art, created by Kate Lacour.
I remember this. It's interesting that we're beginning and ending this show with kind of body horror, isn't it?
Yeah, that's very much what we're doing. So this is one of them art books. So basic idea is it's sort of like it's an anatomy textbook.
Yeah.
With like figures of various body parts. But then with like loads of weird body horror elements thrown in. So one of the few ones that A, I can use my mouth words to describe, and B, is able to be talked about on what is essentially a family-friendly podcast.
Yeah.
Is you see like an outstretched arm with like a lovely little hummingbird flying over to it. And that's figure one. And figure two is the hand still outstretched with now a hummingbird on every finger, their beaks lovingly caressing the ends. And figure three is most of the hummingbirds flying away, with the hand now turning into like a withered talon. And figure four is just the hand with all its juices sucked out.
Ooh,
lovely.
It's basically that kind of stuff. Just all this weird, bizarre. It's like it's vaguely got the theme of it's kind of moving up in the stages of cell growth. So lots of the initial stuff is kind of like about, you know, sperms and eggs, and it moves on to like, you know, cells and then fetuses and then like people.
Hmm.
But it's just, I'm not gonna lie, it's gonna be a very Marmite book. It's just lots and lots of really, really weird pictures. I'm trying to find another one that I can actually see. Yeah. Like a person getting their face scraped off, and then like that flesh is used to build a second face on the back of their head. And if that's the kind of thing that makes you go, interesting, then yeah, this book's probably for you.
I mean, to be fair, it sounds like a Saturday night around our house.
Exactly. But like for some people, it's just going to be, I do not understand this book full of weird pictures.
And you make it sound like the Doctor from The Human Centipede, like his ideas book.
Yeah, his doodles. Well, he's just waiting for the latest victim to be subdued. Yeah. It's like, I'll just...
Actually, I think that's kind of a good point to hit upon, because what I really like about the book is it's kind of what Kate LeCour explains at the back, like she was inspired by the idea of dioramas. So, you know, like you see in the museum where it's like, you know, a rabbit that's been stuffed and it's kind of about to be pounced on by a wild cat or something. And it's this idea of like, first of all, the idea of it, that there's kind of a weird element to that of just like, look at these dead things that we've preserved.
Yeah.
But also that idea that you're kind of seeing like the middle of a story.
Yeah.
Where like you're looking at
it. Yeah, how do you get to this point and what's going to happen from here on in?
Yeah, exactly. So like, so all the things in this book, you're looking at it going, oh yeah, this sort of looks like it should be a diagram that's explaining some kind of process, but you can't quite work out what it is. Like, there's like someone with their fingers getting chopped off with like Latin inscriptions, and then like a weird Illuminati eye like shooting through the hole in their hand. And it's like you put the heart and the brain in the goblet, and then the dove flies into the goblet. And it's like, it's some weird arcane ritual that you just don't have the knowledge to comprehend. And I think that's neat.
Cool. Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
And also highly disturbing at the same time.
It is. Plus, you get to find out just how many parts of the body can be redrawn to look like genitalia. Wow. Spoiler alert, it's all of them.
Although, ironically, not the genitalia.
Well, that would probably kind of defeat the purpose, I think.
Right, so are we done for the day?
I think so. I think that's us.
Okay, so if you want to catch any of our other episodes or any of the other shows on the Geek Show Podcast Network, then you can find them all on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, or on whichever podcast provider or podcast app that you're using, whether it's Audioboom or whether it's Stitcher or Deezer or Spotify or something like that. If you are listening through anything like that, then leave us a rating, leave us a review. It does help us improve and it does help us with exposure. If you are heading to our site, then check out some of our video game reviews and movie reviews and various other things as well. Our shop and Patreon are on there as well. And that's about it from us for this week. We will see you all next week. Until next time then, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Mick.
And we will see you all later.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye now.